Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. Defense Department spends a lot of time peering into the future. And lately, its planners have been looking at a future of climate change. What if a key airbase on the island of Diego Garcia slips beneath the waves of rising seas? What if spreading deserts send millions of desperate Africans in search of food and water? Would super pandemics and typhoons favor the U.S. or Al-Qaeda or anyone? Talk about shock and awe. This hour, On Point, wargaming, global warming. You can join the conversation should climate change be a national security issue for the Pentagon. Do you want, do we need the military to wargame global warming? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll hear this hour from a top Pentagon planner, a retired Army general in the thick of this, and a civilian researcher, all of whom have been wargaming and planning for life and war on a hot planet. But first, from New York, we're joined by Andrew Revkin, environment reporter for the New York Times and author of The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. Andrew Revkin, welcome back to On Point.
It's good to be with you.
A lot of aspects to this, military, political, and climate. First to the military. What's going on that wasn't before in the Pentagon when it comes to climate change and planning, Andrew?
Well, for quite a while, the Pentagon has been considering climate change as part of its long-term risk assessment. I remember back in 2000, 2001, when I was focusing on the Arctic for the first time in a big way, the Navy had already done in 2001 a study called Naval Operations in an Ice-Free Arctic. So It's been there. It's been sort of in the background, though, sort of the more in the think-tanky arm of the Pentagon than in the leadership. And what you've seen lately, I think, is with the Obama administration in office, there's more of a top-down pressure. And actually, Congress has required the Pentagon through spending authorizations to do certain analyses.
And now it's going to, that analyses of the strategic implications of climate change are going to be included in the big quadrennial defense review coming out in February.
Right, right. And again, you know, when your job is to look ahead and perceive risk and do what you can ahead of time to limit the risk and also to win a war if it happens as a result of something, if you're not considering something like the prospect of significant climate change and change in sea levels, then you're not doing your job.
We're going to hear later in this hour from a retired four-star Army general, Paul Kern, who's been right in the middle of a lot of this thinking, who says it's not political pressure that's led to this, that the Pentagon, as you say, has been had an eye on this for a long time. But there are politics at play here. What are they? How do they relate to the legislation on the Hill?
Well, if you saw the Times story by my friend and colleague John Broder on Sunday, in the leading the paper, it was about the growing push by senators who are eager to press climate legislation to make the argument for the security benefits of addressing climate, along with the other arguments related to limiting the downside of what could happen. And so there's a political, especially in facing moderates who are very hesitant to sign onto this bill for economic reasons in manufacturing states and oil states. The thinking is, among folks like John Kerry, that if they can add the security component, then maybe they'd swing some of those folks around.
Give us some of the nuts and bolts of what security implications there might be,
sure.
Andy. What's it look like?
Well, you just have to look at where we're most focused right now, the South Asia, the Pakistan, Iraq, that region, Afghanistan. There's some thinking, even in Afghanistan, that I wrote about way back in 2001 after 9/11, that the rise of the Taliban there was fueled in part by incredible drought they had around that time. So climate conditions, especially extremes, can matter. They can destabilize. They can create a lot of hungry people, a lot of unhappy people. And that can cause you to be more apt to sign on to an extremist group. It can be more apt to create refugees, as we know. Flooding is... coastal flooding, particular in a world with rising sea levels, will be more likely. And that could displace more people. And most of the risk is in poor places, Bangladesh. And you saw it in Myanmar, too. These are not comfort zones. And in the Netherlands, you can spend thousands of dollars to build a floating house, or you can spend billions to build dikes, but that's not, Bangladesh can't do that.
We were talking with our friend John Arquilla at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He reminded us, he said that, you know, the barbarians who brought Rome down in the 5th century were, to a great extent, environmental refugees. All those years ago, big movements of people can ignore borders and security as strategic arrangements.
Yeah, one point that I made on my blog post on .earth related to this, though, that's really important to consider, and I guarantee the Pentagon is considering it too, is that many of the stressors that are going to lead to turmoil, potential turmoil in places like sub-Saharan Africa are there already. Runaway population growth in places like sub-Saharan Africa, you know, Africa is going from a population of roughly a billion to probably 2 billion in the next 50 years, and most in profound poverty, and most in zones that we know already are subject to extremes of climate, drought and or too much rain or not enough. And the other reality that I wrote about is, and this is important to consider too, when you look at the climate science, even if the United States turned off every engine right now, turned off every power plant, and just we sat on our hands and did the perfect kind of Al Gore-style approach to global warming, we're already committed to decades of warming. So through this stretch when Africa doubles and you have this surge of poor young people in many places that are turbulent already, we're committed already to significant warming, and the climate bill would not turn the tide there at all.
Now, it's not just people, population numbers, climate. It's also concern about facilities. One that your colleague John Broder mentioned was the air facilities in Diego Garcia Atoll in the Indian Ocean, just a few feet above sea level. Rising seas could mean no more, that's a refueling spot and supply spot for the Middle East, isn't it?
Yeah, although to my mind, I spent time in some islands near there, the Maldives, which faced the same issue. And when you have wealth and technology, you deal with sea level rise. The Pentagon, if it feels that base is strategically vital, it will protect it and will keep bolstering the seawalls around it and that kind of thing. If you look at Mali, the capital of the Maldives, they've invested hugely in flood walls around Mali, even as the outlying islands become more vulnerable to flooding.
But these are real costs. I mean, Homestead Air Force Base destroyed by Hurricane Andrew in 92, Hurricane Ivan hit the Naval Air Station Pensacola, Norfolk, Virginia's Naval Station vulnerable.
All it takes is one hurricane, even if you're not in a world of more hurricanes, to destroy something important. One thing the Navy is particularly concerned about, and this is similar in a way to having to think about sea level and low-lying air bases, is a whole new ocean they have to deal with. The Arctic, again, I think it's important.
As the ice goes away.
Yeah, there have been studies. The National Academy of Sciences, as I've written the last couple of years, has been pressing the United States and Congress to invest more in icebreakers. Because we, right now, even with warming, there will always be some ice up there, but we have no capacity to guarantee the ability to patrol in Arctic waters right now. And with that region becoming much more of a busy corridor, I wrote recently about a German company that's going to send the first commercial shipment over from China, Asia, around to Northern Europe through the Northern Sea Route. This stuff is happening.
Ironically, as it becomes passable, you need icebreakers to be in on the game. It's not a free ride.
You need to be able to play in that sphere, and right now we don't have the capacity. The Navy and the Coast Guard are concerned about that.
Andrew Ripkin with the New York Times Environment Reporter there. Thank you very much for being, Andrew.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Amanda Dory joins us now from the Pentagon in Washington. She's Deputy Assistant Secretary for Defense for Strategy. She is leading and helping draft the Pentagon's next big quadrennial defense review due out in February 2010. Amanda Dory, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. I'm very pleased to meet you over the phone, so to speak, and to join the show today.
You have said that there has been, we're in the middle of, a sea change in military thinking about climate change. Describe that to us.
Well, the pun was not intended, but we are in the midst of a sea change in terms of our thinking USG-wide, I would say, United States government-wide, as far as understanding the interrelationships between climate change, energy, and national security. The department, the prior speaker, Andrew, correctly noted that the department has been looking at these issues for some time, that we have external reasons why we're focusing on it in our current QDR as well.
What do you mean by that, external reasons? Is that congressional pressure or climate pressure?
Well, both, frankly. The department spends a lot of time looking out into the future, trying to explore where we might be called upon in the future for military missions, and we've always had a long-term view. In that regard, the Quadrennial Defense Review, which is a report to Congress, requires the department to look 20 years out into the future and to talk about future military missions and what capabilities might be required. So there's an external demand signal. That's what I was referring to. Mm-hmm. And the legislation was updated in 2008, thanks to then-Senator Clinton and then-Senator Warner, to include a specific look at the impact of climate change on the military's missions and capabilities in the future.
So as you look 20, 30 years out, do you see strategic implications of climate change? Are they on your radar? Sorry.
Absolutely. We look at trends long-term. The impact on the future security environment and climate and energy are among those trends. Demographics are also very important. The prior speaker referred to those. Trends involving culture and identity and governance, science and technology trends. We spend time trying to understand the data that's available related to those trends and projections, both in terms of internal Department of Defense expertise, but then looking well beyond the department, understanding that we don't have all the expertise on these subjects, and we are in touch in terms of the academic community, the think tank community, international partners. There's quite a community of people who look out into the future, typically with a great sense of humility, since no one has the crystal ball. We can't predict the future, but we can project trends and try to understand what their implications are. And the department really now understands that energy and environment are two sides of the same coin. They are highly interrelated, and they do impact in terms of the future security environment and the kinds of missions the department will be expected to perform.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about climate change and national security. The Pentagon paying attention to global warming, even wargaming it. It's a national security issue. It's also a political hammer, maybe, in the cap-and-trade energy legislation going on, being considered right now on Capitol Hill. We've been joined from the Pentagon in Washington by Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy, Amanda Dory. Amanda Dory, I'm looking here at a quote from General Anthony Zinni. He says, we'll pay for this, that is climate change, one way or another. We'll pay to reduce greenhouse gas emissions today, or we'll have to take some kind of economic hit in doing that maybe, or we will pay the price later in military terms, and that will involve human lives. General Zinni, retired Marine, former head of Central Command, is retired. But is that the view inside the Pentagon, pay now or pay later when it comes to security and climate change?
I think within the Pentagon, there's a very strong demand signal for looking at energy considerations that comes from the operational commanders who are dealing today in Afghanistan and Iraq with the challenges associated with logistics and troop sustainment, highly energy-intensive operations. And there have been demands coming in from the field in terms of assistance and coming up with more energy sustainable approaches to reduce the amount of financial resources applied to logistics, but also in terms of human costs. The force protection assets who are involved with protecting of fuel convoys, the convoy personnel themselves, there are very real operational implications in terms of energy consumption for the department. So this is a very pragmatic look at these issues that stems from understanding mm-hmm. there's a direct impact in terms of operational effectiveness. Moving beyond the operational commanders for the services who have to budget on an annual basis in terms of their fuel costs, for example, for mm-hmm. operational energy, but also in terms of DoD installations and facilities across the United States and then in other locations around the world. To have to budget around the tremendous variability in fuel costs, particularly when prices spike, obviously there's an opportunity cost there in terms of your ability to do other things. When fuel prices rise, you have less funds available in terms of taking care of military personnel, training hours, flight hours, mm-hmm. beaming hours, the ability to procure future capabilities. So it's very much an opportunity kind of opportunity cost situation. I would agree with that.
Secretary Dirk, let me ask you there. I mean, you're I realize all these things are, I guess, interrelated, but you're sort of sliding there toward the energy security issue, which seems to me a little different from climate change itself. I mean, you could have no climate change and still have energy security problems or issues. Do you see that as different from climate change, or is it somehow all the same or all tied up together?
Well, I think at the outset, I was trying to underscore the point that we're viewing climate change and energy security as highly interrelated. The impacts in one sphere impact on the other sphere. So there are operational energy considerations that I just highlighted for you. In terms of operational considerations that flow specifically from climate change, for example, one of the things that the department does both domestically and overseas is provide support to civil authorities in the event of extreme weather events. So, for example, on an annual basis, the department provides support to the Department of Homeland Security and to state and local authorities in the United States. This ranges in terms of hurricanes, tornadoes, fighting wildfires, the full range of natural disasters that impact within the United States. And on a regular basis, for example, in 2008 alone, the department responded within the United States to close to 90 requests for assistance related to extreme weather events. Climate change, we understand from the scientific projections, those extreme weather events are expected to increase in intensity and possibly frequency. So there's a very mission-related dimension in terms of climate change. This also impacts worldwide the intensity of those extreme weather events in other countries, and the United States frequently lends a hand when it can, when it's in place to do so. The State Department is the lead in those instances, and the Department of Defense supports as it's able to. So we foresee directly related to climate change an impact in terms of increasing missions related to extreme weather events and that support that we provide to civil authorities.
It's very interesting. Raises lots of questions, including questions from our listeners. Secretary Dorey, if I may, I'd like to go to some of them. From Des Moines, Iowa, John is calling. John, you're on the air with the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense.
Yes. If this was such an issue and the government's been looking into this problem for so long, why did we have 8 years of inaction? And I'm not going to lay it all on the Bush administration. Bill Clinton probably should have been listening up a little bit, maybe to Al Gore, as far as the environment, especially overpopulation. That just scares the heck out of me. We have to sustain more and more people on this planet, and the resources are getting thinner and thinner.
But 8 years of inaction. I want to put that assessment to Amanda Dorey. Thank you, John. You know, Amanda, of course, climate change itself has been a political football. I mean, Senator Inhofe, Oklahoma, you know, called it. Called it the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. And there was a sense that even at the White House, it was often sort of denied or downplayed in recent years. Has that affected Pentagon planning? That view? Are you now, what, confirming global warming or climate change with this strategic review?
I think in the last administration, you began to see, as the scientific consensus has grown, reflected in the IPCC reports in 2007, progressing through the National Intelligence Assessment that was produced by the intelligence community in 2008. President Bush and his leadership team in the last administration began via executive orders and other means to direct the federal government to take steps recognizing the interrelated aspects of climate change and U.S. national security and energy security. So I think 8 years of inaction is perhaps overstated. I think the action has there was action underway 8 years ago. I think there's a growing crescendo in that regard. The Obama administration, the president has been very clear in terms of talking about the requirement for developed countries who, in a sense, have some historical responsibility to take the lead. And he's talked about climate change as a serious test, but it's also an opportunity for innovation and adaptation. So I think leadership counts, and we're hearing from the president, and he's setting the tone for the rest of the federal government and, indeed, for the country.
Amanda Dorey at the Pentagon, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation, also from Washington, Sharon Burke. She's vice president for national security at the Center for a New American Security. She's directed international climate change war games, futures scenarios. Sharon Burke, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. I'm delighted to be with you.
You've been watching this for a long time and been sort of in it up to your neck in some of these wargaming situations. What are the big issues? If climate change is now on the table as a strategic issue, what does it push, you know, most clearly to the Pentagon's eye or to wargamers' eye when you think about climate change and national security?
Well, I think Secretary Dorey has laid it out very well, which is it's two, I would say, three different basic challenges, right? There's first sort of operational challenges, the ways in which some of the changes, such as sea level rise, more severe storms, shifting precipitation, the way it affects the environment you operate in. Is your infrastructure getting hit by more storm surge? Are your ships having to work in far more turbulent seas? You know, so first, it's your environment. Second, it's sort of the strategic challenges. So if people have to move, where do they go? Does it cause unrest? Do you have to participate in emergency and humanitarian relief? Do you have to participate in wildfire relief and things like that at home? And then finally, there's sort of the geopolitical or geostrategic level of challenge, which is if resources are coming under more pressure, what happens to relationships between states? So, for example, right now, you see countries such as China that are actually buying land in other countries to grow food. How does that affect relationships between states when there's competition for resources?
You've done wargaming, presumably with one of the players being the United States or something like it. Is the Pentagon on the leading edge of thinking about this? Is it behind? Are the implications of climate change, they're not good for anybody, but relatively, is the United States more advantaged, disadvantaged? That sounds crass, I'm sure that's the kind of thing that gets played out.
You know, one of the interesting things, and I think, again, that Secretary Dorey made a really good point, is that we've still been figuring out the science and what the science all means. And it's pretty unequivocal now that this is happening and that human beings are making a contribution. But as to exactly what's going to happen, when, where, how, that is still very complicated. Climate is a very complicated system. So to know exactly what's going to happen is a real challenge. But the Pentagon, one of the reasons that the military, it's so good that the military is taking this on, is what your first guest said, Mr. Revkin, when he was talking about risk assessment and risk management. That's what the U.S. military does, is it looks ahead 10, 20, or 40 years, in the case of the Quadrennial Defense Review, 20 years, and it makes a judgment about what the future might look like, what the risks are, and how you manage it. And consider that when they're looking 20 years ahead, they have to actually procure and train people for that 20-year future right now. So there's, you know, consequential decisions, including involving billions of dollars, at stake in how they look at the future. So in terms of the uncertainty and the risk management, that's how you have to look at it, and that's what the military is very good at. Mm.
Let's get a call from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and Bill. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. I think this may be a bit of a tempest in a teapot. The military has always been training for the extremes in the climatic conditions in which it has to do its business. This is nothing different. If the environment in general raises a couple of degrees or lowers a couple of degrees in 10 or 20 years, today's practices, I think, will be irrelevant. The military will evolve to handle it.
Bill, let us pick that up. Amanda Dorey, tempest in a teapot. Nothing different here. The military always plans for contingencies. Do you see something different about climate change as a factor?
I guess I look at it as more evolutionary than revolutionary. I would agree with Bill that the department does historically take a very long-term view for the reasons that Sharon identified in her description earlier, the long lead times to produce capabilities and platforms, the research and development processes. Of necessity, the department has a very long-term horizon, and that has allowed us to evolve some pretty sophisticated planning processes, use of alternative futures, use of tabletop exercises and wargaming to try to think through and explore different challenges. We do these type of activities at all different levels, the strategic level, the operational level, and the tactical level. We share those techniques with a variety of other stakeholders. We go through games that involve interagency players. There are opportunities where we interface with members of Congress in tabletop-type exercises or with international partners. So there are methodologies for attempting to look out into the future and identify challenges, identify opportunities, and then undertake the risk management approach that Sharon referred to. The department has very robust capabilities in that regard, and we have shared them with others, and we will continue to do so.
Sharon Burke, how about it? Is tempest in a teapot the way to look at this? I mean, climate change is seen as huge by those who really fear it coming. And, you know, Amanda says, of course, the military always plans for contingencies. She says it's evolutionary, not revolutionary. Do you agree? Having war-gamed it, is there some revolution required to address it, confront it?
Well, I think the caller, Bill, I think he's right and wrong. Let me start with how he's wrong. It's not a tempest in a teapot in the sense that the ways in which this is going to be pervasive, the ways in which it affects our life, and as your first caller mentioned, that's locked in for probably decades. If we can't cut our energy use and our greenhouse gas emissions, we could see some very significant changes by the end of the century. And I think your caller just doesn't realize how vast the changes in our way of life could be. So first, I guess I have to reject categorically that it's a tempest in a teapot. But the ways in which he's right are that the U.S. military is very adaptable. And, for example, when we looked at the ways in which the naval environment might change, you might see changes in acidity in the water or in currents and thermoclines. Our folks now are very able to adapt to that. Or even if the temperatures increase, they train for that already. That is certainly true. However, you have to be prepared for these contingencies, and you're not ready for something you don't know to be ready for. And the best example I've ever heard is a former colleague of mine who's a pilot was flying a plane, was flying a squadron back from a war theater in Afghanistan, and they checked the weather report with the Navy meteorologist, as they're supposed to, and started to fly back home. And when they got to the coast off of Morocco, they flew right into a hurricane, a Category 2 hurricane, which for the aircraft they were flying was very dangerous. And they were lucky to get through it unscathed. Now, why did they fly into a hurricane? Well, the meteorologist didn't tell them it was there. The reason he didn't tell them it was there is he didn't know, because there hasn't been a hurricane off that coast since 1842. He didn't know to look for one. But the conditions are changing, and if we don't know what we're looking for, we won't see it, and we won't be ready. So even the U.S. military needs to adjust. If we have full deployments overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan, we need to figure out how we're going to respond to those 90 requests for weather-related response here in the United States. The military has to know what it's up against to be ready for it.
Secretary Dory, we just have you for another minute. Do you agree? Would you say conditions are changing? Climate change is a real factor.
I agree that climate change is a real factor, and I think the department is taking it seriously. We understand that job number one is to prevail in the current operational challenges that we're facing in terms of Afghanistan and successfully concluding in Iraq, but at the same time, we're looking forward into the future, and that's where we look at the possibilities where the department will be called upon for a range of missions. And so we are focused on achieving the balance that the Secretary of Defense speaks to, succeed in terms of the current time frame, but looking out into the future and being prepared to handle whatever challenges that the President may issue at that point.
Fascinating. Amanda Dory, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy. She's leading the drafting of the Pentagon's next quadrennial defense review. It's due out in February. Secretary Dory, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about climate change and national security. The Pentagon paying attention to global warming. It's a national security issue. It's also a political issue. Legislation on energy and climate on Capitol Hill right now. The House has passed a version. Senate's still looking at it. Some Democrats urging the use of national security as a kind of political lever to push on what's seen as a critical issue of climate change. Of course, a lot of controversy around climate change itself between right, left, and otherwise. Sharon Burke has joined us from the Center for a New American Security. She's worked at the Department of Defense, Department of State, was country director in the Department of Defense Office of Near Eastern and South Asian Affairs. She's been out there, knows of what she speaks. With us right now from Arlington, Virginia, is General Paul Kern, retired four-star Army general, was commanding general of the U.S. Army Materiel Command from 2001 to 2004. He serves now on the Military Advisory Board of the Center for Naval Analyses, a nonprofit military research organization dating back to World War II. General Kern, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Enjoy the conversation.
It's great to have you. You've really been looking closely at this with a lot of flag officers sitting around and looking at this. Do you feel prodded by politics to look at climate change or by science? What's drawn you to get involved in this, General?
I've looked at it from the purely from the military aspect. We clearly listen to a lot of scientists, and we've listened to a lot of political views on it, both in the U.S. and outside the U.S. I think the consistent theme was that there was not a lot of agreement between different groups, but the lesson for all of us was that we need to be paying attention, we need to be prepared, and we need to take the actions necessary so that we aren't surprised by events that we are not either or our organizations or our equipment are not prepared to deal with.
So give us a sense. You've really dug into this. You know, we're coming to it, many of our listeners, me for the first time. What kind of military implications do you see writ large if we're looking at a significant threat of climate change?
Well, clearly you heard the story on a weather-related implication, mm-hmm. and one of the planning factors in all military operations has always been weather. Clearly the D-Day invasion was suspended because of weather. But that is often the confusing factor between weather changes and climate change. Climate change being a much more longer-term impact, and therefore it's a little bit more subtle on how you actually plan and take that into uh-huh. account for your military operations. Some of the factors that we looked at were the change in sea levels and what that could do to installations that are located near there. We looked at the Arctic melting and what the opening of a passage through the Arctic meant in terms of military operations. We looked at things like the growing Sahara Desert, in which was causing migration so people could find arable lands. We looked at the implications of where terrorists were training, and they were often in very dry, inhospitable climates, such as we found in Afghanistan, where it is very difficult to get to, and therefore people don't pay a lot of attention. So there are a number of different factors which go into it from military planning.
So you've ticked those off. Let's run through those a little bit. For example, sea level. If we get a significant sea level rise in terms of military implications, what's top of mind?
Well, clearly, particularly our Navy keeps its ships at sea level. That's obvious. But as those ports change configuration or around the world, as we look at where we can get into foreign ports, we have to change our planning factors as to what is accessible and what isn't. Sometimes the factors are because of violent weather making that inaccessible. Sometimes it's just because of the change in sea level.
Are you looking at costs associated with, I don't know, changing U.S. facilities in Norfolk or elsewhere around the country, around the world, raising them potentially? Is that on the table?
I don't think it's on the table yet, but clearly as we look at to the future and base realignment and closure, if there is to be another one, we'll have to consider those type of implications. We have just as much as sea level rising, it's the ability for us to plan operations not just in the United States where we're based, but mm-hmm. where we might be going overseas and planning around the availability or lack of availability of seaports. Most of our military operations, the shipping does occur by sea. So that's just one of the factors.
Arctic melt, what might that mean in terms of U.S. military planning?
There's a tremendous number of implications on the Arctic melt. Clearly, it's a a shorter sea line of passage between the Pacific and the Atlantic, and so that can change the speed of operations as that becomes available. Secondly, we found the availability of people to look for oil, again, the relationship between energy and climate change at the bottom of the Arctic. We find the Russians and the Canadians kind of setting up their stakes in that. The law of the sea and the implications for the U.S. are different up there because we haven't signed up to that. So there are a whole series of implications. And then you come to, as mentioned previously, lack of icebreakers in our forces.
Sharon Burke, you know, things may change when it comes to weather and climate, but then everybody will share the same weather and climate. If it's harder for the U.S., it's harder for anybody else as well. So what does that tell us about planning for climate change, if that's what the Pentagon's doing here? I mean, potential adversaries would be in that same bad weather or challenging climate, presumably.
Presumably, although I think every country in the world will be affected, but certainly for the next couple of decades, different countries will have different effects. And I know, for example, the Russians expect to have a net gain from climate change in the next couple of decades. Whether or not that's the case, we'll see.
What do you mean, a net gain? In what sense, militarily?
Well, militarily in that, first of all, they have access to the Arctic, mm-hmm. and to those sea lines of communication, but also they'll have some land coming into production that wouldn't have been in production before, mm-hmm. as things begin to thaw. I think that they feel like this is not necessarily going to be a problem for them, but I think, you know, since a lot of the changes that are likely to happen are not particularly predictable, such as when precipitation patterns start to change, you may get more rain, but if it falls all at once, it's a flood. So I think it's premature to think that anyone will benefit, but over the longer term, nobody benefits.
You've done wargaming on this. Give us an example or two of some of the most illustrative things that came out of your wargaming in terms of, I don't know, knock-on effects of climate change, situations that you found arising in wargaming from climate change. What did you see that was most interesting or telling?
Well, we had four countries playing, and we actually had nationals from those countries. So we had Chinese players, Indian players, Europeans, and Americans, and they all played either from their own nation or they played for other nations. Mm-hmm. So we looked at the ways in which some of the projections might lead to changes in each of those areas. And what we saw was that in India and China, for example, the Himalayan glaciers will start to melt. And when the melting is accelerated, that means you'll have more floods. So, of course, people have to move in rather emergency situations. Those are, we call them, sudden onset disasters, where people have to flee suddenly. And that also, over the longer haul, that's a problem because that's the water source for millions and millions of people, both in China and in India. So water resources are going to come under significant pressure in those areas. Also, irrigation and as the precipitation patterns shift, rain-fed agriculture will come under pressure. So you may see people having more difficulty raising the crops that they raise right now in China, India, in all of the countries we looked at, including parts of Europe and parts of the United States. So we saw slow onset disasters such as those, and then also all of those countries, Europe to a lesser degree, will have to deal with most likely an increase in storms. And there's still a debate about whether there'll be more storms or just more severe storms.
What are the military implications of these that you've just pointed to?
Okay, so the military implications are, first of all, for humanitarian relief and disaster relief, mm-hmm. because as people have to deal with these disasters, they need help. And the fact is that the U.S. military is probably the only military in the world that's able to respond at any scale. That doesn't mean that the U.S. military should respond, but it's not going to be easy to turn people away. Think about, for example, the tsunami relief. Mm-hmm. Was it an option for us to say, no, we won't help? Sure, of course, but you know, it wasn't
a pretty
practical.
Terrible world if you come to that.
Yes, I think that that's an interesting question, though, because that's mm-hmm. not really up to the military to decide where to deploy to deal with these events. But there's no question that you're going to see an uptick in those kinds of events and an uptick in the demand for U.S. military assets, because the fact is that no one else has the capacity to respond at that level. And if you look at how difficult it is, think about the response to Katrina, where even at home, with that kind of disaster, we had a great deal of difficulty in responding. So that'll be a significant challenge for the military. But also, I mean, again, when you see people moving in those numbers, either moving from slow, twisting disasters like, you know, your crops aren't growing anymore, or from very sudden disasters where you have to flee, that causes problems of all kinds. But I think also maybe one of the best examples is of the kinds of things we might see is Somalia. So Somalia has been suffering under drought and famine for a long time. It's not the reason that the state has collapsed, but it's certainly part of a contributing factor. Somalia now is an anarchic situation, or nearly so, and there's a number of different security problems that causes. First of all, waves of refugees across the region that's destabilizing other countries in the region. Second of all, you have opportunistic terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda affiliates, that are in the country that U.S. military assets have been bombing for years. Now you have piracy off the coast of Somalia that's taking ships, including U.S. ships, hostage, costing millions of dollars, a significant challenge. And you're talking again about small boats with rocket-propelled grenades, but coming from an anarchic state that's falling apart. And then also you had other states in the region intervening in the political chaos. So you actually had military forces from the neighboring countries with U.S. support going into the country. So you know, that's a worst-case scenario, but it's not unrealistic to say that that can happen in a lot of other places in the world.
General Kern, we're talking calmly and coolly here about pretty devastating potential scenario. I mean, millions of people in flight, mass drought, thirst, hunger, and the fallout from those. As a military man, does this turn your mind just to planning and contingency, or, you know, should stopping or slowing climate change be part of a national security agenda, given all this potential fallout?
Well, I think as from the military aspect, the first being able to respond and do your planning and operational requirements is the first priority. There's a lot of long lead time in making sure that you have the right equipment to deal with the issues that have been addressed. Most of them are in the logistics side of the world, and that gets a generally a lower priority, but if you put it down too low, you're not going to be able to respond. On the ability to impact it, I think what we have seen is that the Department of Defense, and it is doing this, should follow best practices to be out in front wherever they can, whether it's efficiencies in use of fuels, whether it's in the environmental considerations of how it designs buildings. All of those we should certainly be in a leadership as part of the government role. Can we, the Department of Defense, change that? Not by ourselves, certainly, but we can be in a leadership position to show people what's possible.
Can you see a situation arising where the kind of humanitarian challenges are so overwhelming? I mean, take the super tsunami times, I don't know, some factor, where the U.S. Army military has to just give up its humanitarian, or would not have the capacity to respond with everything that would mean for our sort of self-understanding and relations with the world. Could it be too much to take on all this? General.
Well, I think the answer is clearly you can paint a scenario where it would be too much for the U.S. military by itself to take it on, and then it's operating in coalitions, which we learn to do during exercises, so we can all work together and have the confidence that people are going to be able to work together. And quite often you see that takes a while to develop, and that's happened in some of the more recent events where around the world we have sent forces to respond and people weren't sure they wanted us there.
Yeah. Let me get a call from Nashville, Tennessee, if I may. Sorry, General. David, you're on the air from Nashville.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to comment on the fact that as recently as a week ago, a group of fellows that I play basketball with, a large majority of them tried to suggest that climate change was a hoax. Most of the information they had gotten was, of course, from conservative talk radio. And I'm wondering what the notion of the Pentagon to, in effect, legitimizing climate change by making these announcements and making these studies does to the discussion for all the people who think that this is just a conspiracy that Al Gore created up.
Sharon, could you pick that up from David in Nashville? What do you say? What does it mean for the national political debate that the Pentagon is having these very real brass tacks planning exercises on climate change?
Well, I think it's just what he suggested, which is, I don't know if I would use the word legitimized because this is something that's happening. But what it helps, I think, the American people understand is that it's not a political issue, and it's not a hoax or a fiction, that this is a real phenomenon that's actually happening, that there are real observations behind it right now, and that when your military says, okay, we take this seriously and we have to plan for it, or more to the point, when your National Intelligence community says the same thing, which it did last year, as Secretary Dorey pointed out, there was a national intelligence assessment on climate change, then people need to rethink what they're hearing, wherever they're getting it from. Your caller said conservative radio. Wherever they're getting it from, they need to rethink it. And I understand this is a very unpleasant thing to have to think about. But when the military and the national intelligence community and the trusted arms of our government that are looking seriously at these issues tell you you need to think about it, then you need to think about it.
General Kern, how do you see it? Is there a risk of doubt around this slowing our national or national security response to climate change? Have we seen that already as a problem? Do you?
Well, I can tell you that 3 or 4 years ago, when we first started this military advisory board study and you had the admirals and generals sitting around the table, there was a lot of questioning as to the validity of what people were projecting. After listening to worldwide experts, though, we agreed that, one, we weren't scientists and we couldn't solve the discrepancies between what people were arguing about from a scientific perspective, but we could see the measured changes that were taking place in the world and agreed that if you wait for 100% assurance, you're going to be too late. So the planning and the operational considerations need to be started and let other people decide on the arguments as to the causes and how we're going to fix it with a scientific background. But from a planning perspective, that's really what the Pentagon does very well and where it can put its best efforts.
Wow. What a picture. Planning across a broad range for the threats that come with climate change. It's been a fascinating hour. It'll be fascinating to see how this all ripples through the political conversation going on Capitol Hill. General Paul Kern joining us today from Arlington, Virginia. General Kern, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom. Good conversation.
And Sharon Burke at the Center for a New American Security, Vice President for National Security there. Ms. Burke, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're most welcome.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.